Did Don Draper really buy the world a Coke? Did Tony Soprano really die, or just order more onion rings? The finales of our favorite shows can make us argue, make us cry, and make us crazy. From Spotify and The Ringer, I'm Andy Greenwald, and this is Stick the Landing, a new podcast where we'll be telling the story of modern TV backwards, one fade out at a time. Find Stick the Landing on Wednesdays on the Prestige TV feed, on Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of The Town is brought to you by FX's The Bear, starring Jeremy Allen White, Ayo Edebiri, and Eben Moss Backrack. Season 2 follows as the crew work to transform their grimy sandwich joint into a next-level spot. It turns out the only thing harder than running a restaurant is opening a new one. Television Academy members can watch all episodes at fxnetworks.com/FYC.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
It is Wednesday, April 10th. One of the buzzwords you hear a lot in Hollywood is consolidation. Bob Iger, the Disney CEO, was just on CNBC last week talking about how important consolidation is in the streaming industry. He's basically saying there are too many streaming services, which makes it too tough to grow subscribers and boost growth to improve profitability. You hear that a lot. That word also is in the news because we are now in April 2024, and that's when Warner Brothers Discovery, the home of HBO and CNN and the Warner Studio, they are freed from the rules of the Reverse Morris Trust, which prevents companies from merging without incurring huge tax penalties. Now, they can go after deals, and the speculation is that Warner Discovery and its CEO, David Zaslav, are on the hunt to either buy or most likely merge with another company, probably a media company. Consolidation. We've all followed the saga as well of Paramount Global, the home of CBS, Paramount, MTV. They are in exclusive negotiations at this point to sell a controlling stake to David Ellison and his Skydance Media, along with some private equity backers. Not consolidation per se, but some of the Paramount assets could be sold to competitors. What all these situations have in common is regulatory review, the government analyzing a bunch of potential impacts on the market, including antitrust violations. And the antitrust positions of the government have changed a lot under Joe Biden, with his Department of Justice looking super closely at mergers and his very aggressive FTC chair, Lina Khan, who was just on The Daily Show talking about her antitrust lawsuits against Apple and Amazon over dominance in their various markets. Part of that Apple suit specifically mentions how Apple is, quote, rapidly expanding its role as a TV and movie producer. The implication is that the content initiative that Apple has undertaken over the past 5 years contributes to its potentially improper market dominance. You don't need me to tell you that big tech has taken over Hollywood, changed the way the entire entertainment industry operates. The question is what, if anything, the government should do about it. My guest today is part of the increasingly vocal group that believes something needs to be done. Matt Stoller is the research director at the American Economic Liberties Projects. He writes the Substack newsletter Big, and he's been on the show before. Today, it's an update on Big Hollywood versus Big Tech, the antitrust angle, and the rules of consolidation. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Matt Stoller of the American Economic Liberties Project, a returning champion. You've been on the show before. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I love your perspective on the deal landscape and the antitrust landscape. And we had some news this past week. Two board members of Warner Discovery, they resigned after the Department of Justice questioned the fact that they were executives at Advance, the media company that owns Condé Nast and some TV assets, as well as serving on the board of Warner Brothers Discovery, which the government said it considers a competitive company. You told me when I asked that you think this is a warning shot that the government is sending to the Hollywood community about the consolidation landscape and some of the goals of these media companies that are trying to get bigger to compete with the tech companies. Why do you think that?
So I would say there's two reasons that they did what they did. So there's a very old law called the Clayton Act, and Section 8 of the Clayton Act says that you can't be on the board of directors of two companies that compete with one another.
Interlocking directors, that's what they call it.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason is because it's just too easy to pass competitively sensitive information in all sorts of subtle ways if you're doing that. And that law really hasn't been enforced much for a long time. And this Department of Justice and the FTC, so the enforcers, are now starting to enforce that law. And they've been doing it in a number of areas, software and private equity, some healthcare. But, you know, they just bring a complaint or tell someone, hey, you guys are two competitive companies, and then someone will resign. So they've gotten a lot of resignations on boards to try to say, yeah, Section 8 of the Clayton Act was a real thing. And this is part of that. I mean, they just thought, okay, you can't be on the board of two companies that compete. It's a pretty black and white, you either are or you're not. And so they resigned.
Well, but Advance doesn't own either of these companies. It is an investor in these companies. Subtle difference. It's not, you know, it's certainly pretty clear that these companies do compete in certain areas, but they're not owners of both.
That's right. And the interlocking directorates is not about joint ownership. It's about joint control or subtle joint. It's just a prophylactic, sure. Right? It's like a stop sign. Not every time you run a stop sign, you're going to get into an accident. But it's also, I think, a warning shot, because the administration and the Department of Justice is paying close attention to what is going on in Hollywood. I mean, you saw there was an Apple antitrust complaint, and part of that complaint was saying, hey, you know, they're leveraging their control of the smartphone into control of speech through movie production.
Yeah, let me read the exact language of that suit. It said that, quote, Apple's conduct extends beyond just monopoly profits and even affects the flow of speech, including by, quote, rapidly expanding its role as a TV and movie producer, end quote. What does that mean? Because I think when you ask people in Hollywood about Apple's initiative in the entertainment business, it's pretty small. I mean, yes, they are Apple and they're one of the largest companies in the world, but the amount of content Apple is making and the influence they exert over the entertainment community is certainly not monopolistic on its face.
No, it's not. And that's not the main claim of the Department of Justice. What they're saying is Apple has all sorts of ways of switching costs from an Apple smartphone to another smartphone. And they're also leveraging their control of smartphones into all sorts of parts of the economy. So, for example, when you pay for something on your iPhone using your tap and pay, Apple gets a small fee. And there's a couple $100 billion of transactions every year now on that. And they don't allow other financial institutions to use that chip on the smartphone. They're also going into the automotive industry and they're saying, hey, we're going to take over the whole experience of driving a car because of CarPlay. It's a leveraging. This is how they're extracting profits from their smartphone monopoly. And one of the things, what the DOJ was saying is that Apple TV might be one of these areas where they're trying to leverage their market position in terms of smartphones, and that it does allow them to shape speech in some ways, but it's not a monopoly. I don't think that was the claim.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So back to the Warner Discovery and the interlocking directors.
Yeah. So there's a lot of chatter about consolidation in Hollywood. There has been for some time. And this administration has made it really clear that they want to stop consolidation. And I think the analogy to Hollywood, the streamers, would be the Simon & Schuster and Penguin merger or attempted merger a couple of years ago, where there were five main trade publishers, and there's an attempt to move from five to four, and with a bunch of smaller ones, and they challenged it, and they challenged it based on increased bargaining power in terms of buying books, so not being able to raise prices for books, but being able to lower what's paid to authors, and also being able to erode the diversity of viewpoints published through trade books, and they won.
That is a key difference. And we talked about that last time you were on the show. Typically, when antitrust analysis is done, the consumer is the client or the person that the government is trying to protect. Here in that publishing case, it was the authors and the diversity of opportunities for authors to sell their books. That was the harm.
Yeah, and that's how I think the DOJ would approach, you know, mergers in the streaming space. And I think you've seen, I mean, there's clearly, like, you saw a lot of commentary to the Federal Trade Commission, which has a suit against Amazon, one of the other streamers in adjacent space. But you saw a lot of public commentary with the FTC from stakeholders in Hollywood. I imagine there have been similar conversations at the DOJ. I think the DOJ is listening. So it's not going to be an easy road if there's an attempt at more consolidation. It's just not, I mean, there's just too much. And I think one of the other parts that we've seen with consolidation, and something that I think came out of the Penguin, Simon & Schuster merger, is that diversity of viewpoints is important. And the particularly the ability of China to control speech and to control movie making is, I think, of significant concern. That's why Apple matters, because Apple is very clear that they don't want any chatter about China on anything that they touch. But I think you've seen that with some of the other streamers. So I think there is a fear that consolidation allows for more control of domestic speech and artistic creation by the Chinese government, just because there's so much investment that some of the streamers have in China.
Because if you're a tech company and you get large enough, you have to care what China thinks in order to keep growing. And if you care what China thinks, you have to start censoring. That's the argument.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just the tech companies. I mean, Universal and Disney both have significant investments in China. And everyone knows that China has immense control over, or had immense control over, over plots, over dialogue.
Yeah, although that's kind of waning, because the box office has kind of disappeared. But, you know, Disney has the park there, and Universal, I think, would like to be more in that business.
You know, I'm not saying you need this, but when are you going to see a Chinese villain, right? When are you going to see China portrayed in a negative light?
That has not happened in 15 years.
Right. So it's waning potentially, but you're not seeing it really, like, I mean, that's just in theory. In reality, it hasn't waned. And I think that's a significant problem. And that's going to come out in any attempt at consolidation.
Yeah. I mean, we just talked about this last week on the show about documentaries and how the large streamers are risk averse. And we saw what happened with Jon Stewart at Apple, where he wanted to talk about China. He wanted to talk about AI. And Apple was not into that. And all of a sudden, he's now on a US-based platform, Comedy Central, owned by Paramount Global. And he can talk about it, because they are not. Now, Paramount Global is up for sale. It looks like David Ellison, the son of the tech mogul, is going to buy it. But anyone could buy Paramount Global. And if it went to a competitive company, you'd think the government might step in there?
I mean, every case is its own special snowflake. But I think there's a pretty good chance. I mean, I think people in Hollywood have had enough consolidation.
You do. Bob Iger doesn't think so. He went on CNBC last week and said that consolidation was necessary in streaming because nobody can make any money, because the tech companies are so powerful. There's now 6, 7, 8 large mass market streaming services. He thinks there needs to be consolidation, and lots of people in Hollywood share his view.
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, Bob Iger's made significant strategic errors. He's just a bad executive.
Oh, you think so?
Obviously, he's a clown. I mean, it's ridiculous.
A clown. Bob Iger is a clown. Explain why.
I mean, it's really obvious. You know, it came out during the strike what he really thought. You know, the executive suite they're people who are, you know, they're fad chasers, right? They all ran into streaming when it looked cool.
Well, it didn't just look cool. The analysts were cheering them on to compete with Netflix. So they did.
Okay, fine. And you had certain financial reasons for doing it as well. But, you know, there were other strategies. You know, they could have said, this doesn't make any sense, and looked for other ways to actually structure the market, but they didn't. And so that's the situation that they're in. They can fix it, but it would actually require making difficult choices and genuine leadership. And there isn't genuine leadership in the C-suite at Hollywood right now. And that's pretty obvious. So they made a lot of mistakes. And the cutting, I don't want to go into that. I mean, you guys can, this is your industry. It's not my industry.
Yeah, no, I get it. But when it comes to the consolidation of streaming services, what is your recommendation if not consolidate?
Well, first of all, consolidation often, you know, I've heard the argument, we need consolidation to compete with the big guy over there for a long time. We've heard it forever. We heard it with Boeing in the 1990s, right? Instead of, we need to consolidate the aerospace industry to compete with Airbus. You know, how did that work out? It didn't work out great.
Yeah.
We heard it when AT&T Time Warner in 2017, 2018, 2019 wanted to consolidate. They literally said, we need to do this to fight Google and Facebook. And how did that work out, right? The judge bought the argument. How did that work out? It didn't.
Well, let's ask that question, because there's an argument to be made that if Time Warner did not do that deal, they would be in Paramount's situation right now, too small to compete, and they don't have a fighting chance as a subscale streaming service and studio against these large competitors.
The best way to address the problem is just to actually go to the government and say, restructure the market, write new rules, and create vertical separation between the distribution and the production. And then you will have an actual market again.
Which existed in, you know, for many decades and was abolished in the 90s. The FinCEN rules went away. All of a sudden, distributors could own their own content, which changed everything.
One of the things to understand about where we are is that the elimination of FinCEN happened because of decades of arguments about the need to unleash studios, unleash distribution, allow for all sorts of creative new ways of putting together industries. And I think people really bought into that argument. And then today we wake up and we have these really dominant firms that are not allowing creative people to make good content and make money at it. And we're trying to figure out what to do. And one of the consequences is a bunch of antitrust suits against big tech firms. The DOJ actually is saying Apple can shape speech through its movie studio in ways that are problematic. Arguments about a policy action around TikTok, policy action around a whole set of media institutions. But we still have to rebuild that argument that we can do more than that, that we can actually deliberately structure markets the way that we used to do. And this is not just a problem in Hollywood, right? We have not seen a real answer to, say, Boeing, right? Which we all know is a huge, huge, huge problem. We need someone to get in there and actually fix that institution, right? We all fly, right? This isn't just a Hollywood style problem. Eventually, we will get in there and fix Boeing, because we all know it has to be done. It's the same thing with Hollywood. It just requires leadership to actually say, let's fix this. And instead, you've got Bob Iger going on TV saying, yeah, my legacy is going to be selling out and burning down the rest of what I haven't burned down already in Hollywood. And that's embarrassing. It's a problem. Well,
I don't think he would put it that way.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
Do you think that the result of these suits against Apple and Amazon could be a decree that separates distribution and streaming from production of content?
I don't think so. I think those are going to be specific to the smartphone. They're going to be specific to Amazon mm-hmm. Prime. I think it will affect their streaming services. And, you know, those are not irrelevant players, but they're not the major players. But they are important insofar as streaming it's not even a side business. It's almost irrelevant to their bottom line. So one of the problems with those institutions in Hollywood is if you have to compete against people who don't have to make money, it's really hard. And I think those suits could have a significant impact on that part of the streaming market.
How so?
You know, the argument in the FTC's case against Amazon is that Prime generates cash through a form of monopolization where they squeeze third-party sellers, and that ends up hiking prices around the economy.
They favor their own produced products, that kind of stuff.
If you're a third-party seller on Amazon, you pay 50% of your revenue to Amazon in terms of fees, right? And then Amazon takes that money and they give you free, quote-unquote free shipping, but they also spend it on Amazon Studios. That's why Amazon Studios doesn't have to make money, because that money is, that cash is coming from the squeeze that they put on third-party sellers. And then, you know, there are reasons why that's anti-competitive. If you get rid of that ability to squeeze third-party sellers, then there's no more cash for Amazon Studios, and they're going to have to make money by actually producing content that people want to pay for.
God forbid.
I know, my God.
They can't give Ben Affleck $130 million to make a $40 million movie anymore, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is that the basis of the business has become irrational, because it's about chasing market power. And the whole point of restructuring a market is to say, no, the basis should be, if you make good movies, you make money. Or if you make popular movies, I don't know, good movies, but make popular movies, you make money. If you don't, you don't make money. And right now, that's not how the business works.
No, it's not. I mean, or at least it hasn't for the past 5 to 7 years, when the goal has been to increase market share and subscriber numbers. And the streamers are essentially in a different business than the movie companies. And you see it play out all the time. I mean, I talk to executives at traditional legacy companies that laugh when they see what Netflix and Amazon are paying for certain movies. That happened with Saltburn, the movie that went to Amazon. And that was a competitive process. There were other bidders for that. But companies like Focus Features, Searchlight, the typical traditional homes for a movie like that, they're looking at their P&L and they're like, okay, we can pay like, you know, $20 million maybe. And then Amazon will come in and be like, no, we're good with like $50, $60 million for that.
Right.
They're just like, okay, go for it. Good for you.
Right. And there's an argument, like the argument that a lot of these companies put out, the tech companies, is, you know, they're so innovative, right? They're better at competing. And it's like, but there's nothing particularly innovative about overpaying for a movie. They don't have a better business model. They're just extracting from third-party sellers that sell power strips or, you know, whatever widget, and then using that to undermine people that actually know how to make movies and distribute movies in Hollywood. It's a completely inefficient model. And that's, I think, the argument from that'd be the argument I would make.
Against Apple and Amazon in particular. Netflix is different. It's only in one business. Their interest was completely upending the traditional compensation model for Hollywood talent. And they did that through aggressive pricing of what they would pay for movies, overpaying people up front, and using debt that they were able to raise based on their valuation and their trajectory to essentially corner the market for a while and accumulate talent before they had the scale that justified the debt they were raising. And now they're a very profitable company. It's similar to what Amazon did in the very beginning. Used other people's money to corner a market, and then all of a sudden they became profitable.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Netflix looks like a utility to me. And they're not like Amazon and Apple. But I think the streamers that are not those three have an interest in a market where if they make content that's popular, they make money. And if they don't, then they don't make money. Right now, they are just it's a losing battle for them. And that's because the rules are set up in a way that privileges market power over the ability to make things that people want. So that's the fundamental driving factor. And that's, I think, what enforcers are looking at too. That's how they see the world.
So let's say Warner Brothers Discovery finds some merger partner, whether it's NBC Universal, Paramount, although that doesn't look like it's happening, someone somewhere else. How quickly do you think the government would step in? Is that an automatic? Comcast will not be allowed to merge NBC Universal with Warner Discovery, at least not under this administration?
I think it'd be really hard, because it's such an easy case to make. You know, first of all, it's the federal government has its ability to bring a case. the administration might change. You know, there's an election coming up, so there's a big, could make a bet. Well, we'll just bet that Trump will win, and if he wins, maybe his
Trump tried to block the last deal.
Not Disney Fox.
No, he tried to block Warner AT&T.
Yeah, I know. And then he didn't block Disney Fox.
I think that was a favor to Rupert, though, right?
I mean, you could make whatever arguments you want about why it happened.
Rupert didn't tell me that, but you got to assume that if that was Disney buying, you know, Comcast or some other company, that they would have paid a little bit more attention than the owner of the most powerful conservative news channel that Trump cares very much about. He didn't want to upset that.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly make that argument. I wouldn't, like, I don't know for sure that that's true, but, you know, they could have just let it through because they're like, mergers are good. You know, who there's many reasons why they could have let it through. But that's a bet you could make. But there are state officials who can bring cases too, and you've started to see them be increasingly assertive. So I don't think you can bet that a merger will go through, even if Trump wins and Trump adopts a posture of sort of a libertarian way of thinking, which he may not do, right? I mean, nobody knows what Trump is going to do or who he's going to pick. So I just think the path is pretty uncertain. And I suspect that if the Biden administration stays in office, I can't imagine that a merger of that size and scale in this industry with such anger at the streamers already would go through without a challenge. It would just be hard to imagine that. And I also want to make one other point, which didn't come up, but we talked about Apple and China and AI, but we didn't talk about how Apple wouldn't let John Stewart interview a regulator, Lina Khan, who is Federal Trade Commission chair. And they just were like, please don't invite her onto your Apple podcast. And that's crazy, right? I mean, that's a big deal to be like, we're not going to allow key political speech on our platform because, you know, from the government, because we think it might harm our business interests. That's a big deal. And I don't think you can overstate the impact that I think a lot of policymakers take away from that.
Yeah, it was sort of like the suspicions we have about companies and censoring speech. Oh yeah, those are true.
That's right.
And it could it help in an antitrust case? That's the question. I mean, maybe this is good evidence for the, you know, federal enforcers that they could make a case that Apple is leveraging its market power to stifle speech. That is good evidence for them. Is it dispositive evidence? I don't know. I mean, companies can do whatever they want. You look at what Elon Musk is doing on Twitter, amplifying certain voices, downplaying others. These are privately held companies.
So an antitrust case is a story. It's not just a bunch of nerds presenting, you know, technical evidence to an oracle, right? A judge is a person, and you have to tell a story to the judge about why something is unlawful, and you have to present evidence. There's often technical evidence. But at the end of the day, it's a morality play. And so having them say, no, we're not going to allow this antitrust enforcer who was appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, to be on your streaming service, it's not necessarily illegal. It isn't illegal, but it indicates an authoritarian mindset.
True.
Tell a judge, you're like, these guys are aggressive and they are almost lawless and they just don't care about society. As an example, they won't even let government officials speak when it harms their interests. They won't talk about China. They won't allow conversations about AI. This is a dangerous company. Oh, and here's all the evidence of their market power, right?
Yeah. Although, just putting on my lawyer hat for a second and saying, if I were representing Apple, I'd say, what are you talking about? This is how the marketplace of ideas works. John Stewart didn't like our policy. He left. He went to an equally powerful media company, and lo and behold, he interviewed Lina Khan. It went everywhere on the internet, and the speech found its home. So why is that our problem?
Well, no, I mean, I think you would. That's a very persuasive case if the claim was that Apple violated the law by not inviting Lina Khan to talk. But that isn't. It speaks to the mindset, right?
Yeah. No. Definitely. It just looks bad. It makes them look terrible. Right?
It looks terrible. And it's like a guy who there's an allegation of domestic violence and you see him like shouting at people in a public restaurant. It's like, it doesn't look good, right? That's what it is, right? It's not legal to shout at someone in a restaurant, but it certainly, you know, like if there are other allegations, you're kind of like, yeah, that guy seems pretty angry, right? I mean, that's what it was with Apple.
All right. Well, a lot of this stuff is going to come to a head in the next couple of years, I think. And we're going to see the antitrust story be a very big story. So we will come back to you. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. Can I just say one last thing?
Yeah.
I want Bob Iger to be the leader we know he can be and push for fixing the industry. We want leadership.
What do you want Bob Iger to do?
I want him to go to Congress and say, we need to fix this market. That's what I want.
And reinstitute the FinCEN rules prevented Disney from having the vertically integrated content and distribution platform that is extremely powerful and profitable for him. You want him to disavow that. Nelson Peltz would be on his back in 20 seconds and he would be voted out of his job.
Well, I mean, he's talking about there were rumors he wanted to sell ABC to private equity. I mean, he could just say, yeah, I don't want to get rid of my distribution assets because it's not as good as it used to be. And I mean, I want leadership. That's what I'm looking for. That's what I think a lot of people in are looking for, you know, not just in Hollywood, but across the nation. And Hollywood's as good as example as any.
All right. Well, on Disney, I think they are going to reserve you a spot in Fantasyland for your wish for Bob Iger. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
All right. We are back with the call sheet. Craig, what is your allegiance towards and feelings about Francis Ford Coppola?
As a director in Hollywood?
Yeah, just like, I'm curious, like, what your awareness, are you a Godfather fan? Do you, you know, Apocalypse Now? What does that mean to you?
It means a lot to me. I am a massive Godfather fan, and I think, you know, he is one of the most important directors of our time. And
however,
with that
he's
said,
also 84 years old.
But you know what? Everyone's going on the age thing. Ridley Scott, Michael Mann, all these other guys are in their 80s. Scorsese.
Yeah. And they're over the hill.
Well, they're all making good movies.
I hate to say it. They're making okay movies, not what they did. But so the reason we're talking about this is because Coppola just did a screening last week for his new movie, Megalopolis, which is a dystopian sci-fi-ish kind of end of the world movie with Adam Driver and a bunch of others, and did not go well. I wrote about this last week in my Puck newsletter. The audience was all the big hitters, all the studio heads, all of the talent that he's worked with. And there were a lot of heads shaking after this movie. It didn't make sense in parts. And it was a very bold swing, as they say. He spent $120 million of his own money. He sold off a bunch of his winery assets to make this movie. And it took a long time. And now he's looking for someone to buy this movie and distribute it. And my prediction is he's not going to get a big studio to take this on. He's going to settle. Someone will pick it up, but he's going to have to settle for a small independent specialty distributor that is not going to pay anywhere near what he wants. And he's probably going to have to put up a lot of the P&A money himself, the Princeton Advertising, to release the movie, much like Kevin Costner has done with his Horizon Westerns at Warner Brothers. And this is not going to be a good financial outcome for Francis Ford Coppola, unfortunately.
Some of the quotes from this THR article are pretty funny. It says, everyone is rooting for Francis and feels nostalgic. Does it go all over the place? Yes, but it's really imaginative and does say something about our time.
It does, doesn't it? It does. It says, don't spend $120 million on your own movie if you're 84 years old. All those guys are not putting up that kind of money for their own movies. I know Michael Mann put a lot of his own money into Ferrari, which cost $120 million and did not do well. That movie did find a U.S. distributor in Neon, but Neon did not pay a lot of money to distribute it. And I think something similar will happen here. Not with Neon per se.
Well, Neon doesn't pay even close to $100+ million for any movie.
Of course not. And Ferrari only went to Neon for US rights because nobody else wanted to release it. He thought he'd get a big studio to come in and release Ferrari, and it didn't happen. And the same is true here. I mean, Coppola has a long relationship with Paramount, obviously the Godfather movies. And I think Paramount's in a tough spot here because there's no way they want to release this movie. I mean, one person told me it's unreleasable. I didn't go there in my newsletter, but Kim Masters in her piece did go there. There's a scene apparently with John Voight who apparently has an erection, 85 years old in the scene. And he and Aubrey Plaza have an interaction that I think a lot of people in the theater were laughing at. There's a lot of other stuff that is sort of baffling. At one point during the screening, there was a live person that came up and started to have a dialogue with the screen, which apparently is like baked into the movie. So try replicating that in a multiplex environment where you've got to have a person come down and talk to the screen during the movie. I don't know that that's going to translate. Like, it's clearly an experimental arty film from a guy who does not give a shit what people think, and more power to him. But financially speaking, this does not seem like a good outcome.
This could be David Ellison's first big splash.
It could be. It could be. Maybe Larry will see it and love it and just buy it and release it via Skydance.
He was probably at the screening.
I don't know if Ellison was there or not, but I would have, if I were the Coppola people, I would have definitely tried to get him there because you never know who's going to fall in love with this movie. I don't know. Knowing who knows, this could end up being Best Picture next year, and we're going to replay this clip and have egg on our face. But I'm betting we will not. All right, that's the show. I want to thank my guest, Matt Stoller. I want to thank producer Craig Horlbeck, our editor, Jesse Lopez. And I want to thank you. We'll see you one more time this week.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.